Kammerflimmern und mediales Rauschen. Podcast für Medien und Wissenschaft. Von und mit Maike Bold und Anna Wiel. Produziert von Avinus e.V.
Herzlich willkommen zur ersten Spin-off-Folge von Kammerflimmern und mediales Rauschen, das Dokumentarische im Digitalen. Eine Sonderreihe von unserem Podcast, die sich mit non-fiktionalem Erzählen in und mit digitalen Medien befasst, mit Interaktivität, Co-Kreation, Partizipation und Immersion, mit emergierenden Praktiken im Grenzbereich von Dokumentarischem, von Kunst, von Wissenschaft und von vielen anderen Bereichen. Und an dieser Stelle werde ich gleich ins Englische switchen, denn diese Folge ist nicht nur die erste, sie ist auch eine besondere, wie gleich zu hören sein wird. So, welcome to this first spin-off episode of Kammerflimmern and Mediales Rauschen, the documentary and the digital, or in German, das Dokumentarische im Digitalen. This spin-off of Kammerflimmern und Mediales Rauschen, as you know, is already a special one. Yes, the focus of the following episodes in the series will go in the same direction. They will be dedicated to emerging documentary practices and digital media cultures, interactivity and participatory formats. However, this first and very special episode is not only in English, as I'm delighted to have two great internationally renowned guests from the UK and Colombia. It is also a very topical issue. We will review ruptures that the last year of the pandemic has brought to our private and professional lives. And we will speculate on the future of the documentary in the digital, especially in co-creative documentary practices. It is more than a year by now that we have to live with the virus. Though in some places and areas of life there are less strict regulations and we are all hoping for the vaccination, the COVID-19 lockdown is still with lots of us. And, what is at least as important, the experiences of the lockdown have left their traces. Not only has the last year been accompanied by a shocking upheaval of all so far assumed certainties, facts and truths, it has also brought along deep permutations in all spheres of our lives, our professional lives and, above all, personal, private, intimate lives. All this has not been without effect for what it means to make documentary. Though closeness and connectivity are essential in times of upheaval and cataclysm, as well as preservation and negotiation of effects of the pandemic and its consequences, doing documentary, especially doing documentary in collaborative, co-creative ways, has become more or less impossible. At least, if one thinks of traditional practices. This might be one reason why during the lockdown the community experimented with alternative ways of doing documentary, in form of online practices, for example, social media initiatives with their documentary impetus, as well as collaborative web projects. The motives are various, and often one and the same project serves different needs at the same time for different user participants. Apart from the urge to document unprecedented times, they are platforms to reach out and feel connected, but they are also means to self-reflexively cope with a slowdown, confined lifestyle and make social distancing more bearable. One thing is evident in all these projects, based on co-creation and active creative participation. The yet thin line between authors and documentary subjects has been almost completely suspended. Today, I have the opportunity to talk to Sandra Gaudenzi, an acknowledged expert in the field of interactive and immersive documentary practices, and to Sandra Tabaris Duquet, an engaged audiovisual producer of award-winning projects and films with experience in transmedia and impact production. The two initiated together, though being placed on different continents, Sandra Gaudenzi in the UK, Sandra Tabaris Duquet in Colombia, a co-creative documentary project, The Corona Haikus. In this insightful conversation, we will talk about the genesis of the project, which started as a Facebook documentary and which then moved to a curated collaborative web documentary. We will talk about their motives to initiate the project and the various motives for the over thousands actively participating co-creators all over the globe. We will also talk about the different functions co-creative documentary projects such as the Corona Haikus can have, which will then bring us to the ethics of co-creation and the responsibilities when creating a community, especially if it is launched as a documentary artistic Facebook project. We will wonder together whether we are currently witnessing a further shift from a representative paradigm to a performative paradigm of doing documentary, in which doing documentary and doing it collaboratively becomes at least as important as the documentary product. And we will also envision what the documentary might become in the future. As such, the conversation, insightful due to the combination of theoretical reflections and first-hand practice experiences, can be seen as a snapshot of a current situation, as an analysis of the status quo, but also the quo vadis of collaborative interactive documentary. I'm so delighted to have as my first two guests two experts in digital documentary practices, Sandra Gaudenzi and Sandra Tabaris-Duque. Welcome to both of you. Sandra, in the UK, you are quite well known in the documentary community, especially in the community of scholars and practitioners in interactive storytelling, due to your seminal book, The Living Documentary. But maybe you could shortly recontextualize your research and your other activities for our German listeners. Oh no, let's do the other way around. A normal introduction is maybe too conservative for so innovative people as you two are. So why not introduce each other?
Amazing idea. Tabaris, go for it.
Great. Okay, well, hi Anna. Hello everyone. It's a pleasure to be here with you all. And it's a pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague, Sandra Gaudenzi, who is an internationally acknowledged authority in the field of interactive and immersive documentary practice. Sandra is a senior lecturer at the University of Westminster and course leader for the Digital and Interactive Storytelling Lab MA, as well as a visiting fellow at the Digital Cultures Research Centre, the University of West England. However, Sandra is not only one of the most active researchers on interactive documentary practices in the UK. Sandra, as my colleague, is also a practitioner. She comes from TV production and she has been consulting, mentoring, researching, lecturing, writing, speaking, and blogging, gosh, she does everything, about interactive factual narratives for the last 20 years. And in 2015, she initiated IFLAB, Interactive Factual Lab, a creative training and accelerator scheme where people could ideate and prototype their interactive projects. So welcome, Sandra. A pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And this is another Sandra speaking. We have a lot of Sandras today on this program. And it will be my pleasure to therefore introduce Sandra Tabaris-Duque, who has just introduced me, which I think is actually quite a nice exercise. And it is a pleasure to be able to introduce such a talented producer who's been living in different countries and mixes the acknowledgement of more than one culture and what it means to transmedia production and to audiovisual production. She combines this research, teaching, practice, and produces wonderful documentaries. I actually would really suggest that you check her website at sandalionproductions.com to know more about her project.
We will add the links in the show notes, of course.
Fantastic. And we have in common a passion for transmedia and immersive narratives, and also for the idea of experimenting with what technology allows us to do when the focus is speaking about reality and what touches us and what concerns us. And so it has been a real pleasure to work with her and a real pleasure to be part of this podcast. And thank you, Anna, for inviting us.
Thank you for being here. And welcome to both of you. Well, the reason why you're here is that you started a quite interesting project, the Corona Haikus. And after more than a year of the pandemic and almost 1 year since your co-creative project launched, could we maybe travel back in time, back to the day when you came up with the idea to initiate this project? What was your incentive, your motivation, or maybe even your urge to get the project started?
Okay, so we're traveling back in time to almost a year back now. And this idea started to come up when we realized at the beginning of March that what we had planned, which was to meet in the UK for work, I was traveling from Colombia to the UK to attend IDOC's conference last year and also to do a session at the University of Westminster. And when we realized that the borders were closing and we were not going to be able to meet to do some work, we decided, okay, it seems like what is coming is an interesting moment, and we have to be very locked down. And what are we going to do to be in touch with? And also, it was a moment where there was a lot of uncertainty and anxiety about what was coming, and not knowing for how long we were going to be unable to travel and to move around, and not knowing when we were going also to see our loved ones. So that was the moment in which we decided, okay, let's try to find ways to be connected. And Sandra has a good knack for coming up with good ideas, and she came up with the idea of the format.
You know, like all ideas are co-created, and this one was co-created too, because it emerged from a long Skype conversation where I think pretty much what was dominant was a form of deflation for all the projects that we would have to put on hold. And I think what is interesting is when I think back about it, I really see the connection on how an emotion really becomes the spring that allows an idea to emerge. And so for me, the opposite of deflation is creation. And so what we were looking for in our Skype conversation, where pretty much we were saying to each other that we would not see each other in Europe, was a way to be connected through creativity. And so we were looking for a very simple idea that could allow this to happen. And the idea that came was to do what I had called visual haikus. And that was a practice that I had done in the past. And that pretty much is a very simple form of visual communication, which is to extrapolate the Japanese poetic haiku, which are three lines with 17 syllables. But pretty much the intention of that form of poetry is to grab the moment and to simplify to a level that it's only the emotion that gets expressed. What I have called the visual haiku is to keep that intention, but instead of doing it mainly with words, is actually to do it with three photos. So it's replacing the idea of three lines with three photos and having just a very short text. And I had in the past played with that format when I was doing my PhD, but also then lately I had been playing with it in using social media platforms like Instagram, and Sandra Tabares as well was doing it. That was a common playground in a certain way. So it was a language that we had both had fun with, that had allowed us to connect to emotion and to express things very quickly with a very playful feeling behind it, but at the same time somehow catching the essential.
So then the Corona Haikus is certainly a very special form of documentary practice, both regarding its genesis, its form, its format, and for sure regarding the process of production. Because as you mentioned, it was a social media project at the beginning. When you got the project started, you made an open call on Facebook, didn't you? And you also took Facebook as initial platform to start from. What exactly made Facebook attractive in your eyes for such a creative project?
When we decided the format, we started looking for platforms because as much as we wanted to do it for ourselves, we also wanted to reach out. We knew that we needed to have it fast. We knew that we didn't have a budget to create a platform. And we also knew, because our previous experience, how difficult it is to bring people to new platforms, to create, how expensive it is to create a new platform. And even if it can be done not so expensively, it is really time consuming and it's really long, the process of bringing people to a new platform. So we started exploring the different platforms that were available, and we knew we had some characteristics that this platform needed to have. One, that it could accept photos. Two, that it could accept text at the same time. And it could accept photos, not just one photo. It needed to accept three photos. It needed to accept text and needed to be co-created, which means that a lot of people needed to be able to be on the same platform interacting with each other, which is the reason why Instagram didn't work for that. So we looked at different options and Facebook started punctuating as the winner, but we resisted it for a while for all the ethical reasons. But at the end, we decided that considering that we wanted to start getting the ball moving fast and that what we wanted was to be in touch, we knew that most people were on Facebook. We decided that we wanted to give it a go. And that's what we did. We started posting our own haikus and we connected our close friends and we invited them to participate if they felt like. They told their friends and they started expanding. And from then onwards, there was a creation of community that rapidly grew.
Yes, we both resisted Facebook for a long time because we have ethical issue around it. But I think somehow there was also one thing that for me at least made it acceptable to go for Facebook was the idea to somehow misuse an existing platform. So to use the affordances that it gives you, which are all the ones that Sandra has expressed, it was doing what we needed to do. And then to misuse it in the sense that, you know, overall as a project, it is a project that wants to connect people through sharing the essential, through the idea of looking differently at their reality. And actually, if you want, it's a project that is pretty much against the logic of the selfie. I mean, if you go through the Corona haikus, you will hardly see any selfie or anybody portraying themselves. It was not about looking good, regardless from the dramatic situation outside. It was the opposite. It was about learning to look at your environment, which at that moment was pretty much our homes because it was the first lockdown that we had gone through. And so it was an invitation to look differently and accept stillness and grab it with your phones and make poetry out of what is actually painful. So I think this is normally not what we see in social media, where we tend to not go for the essential, but more go for the, I was about to say the fake. I mean, that would be probably an overstatement and probably would not be fair. But, you know, it's about the aesthetic of the essential as opposed to the aesthetic of what we are not. And I think that made it for me very, very exciting.
That's a very, very interesting notion of doing documentary then, because it's very subjective, it's very poetic. And I was wondering, is it still documentary? I was actually recalling the famous notion of the documentary truth claim, which is central to the documentary endeavor as such. And the challenge to make such truth claims in time when truth often turns out to be very elusive and fugitive or volatile. which is certainly the case in times of unprecedented crisis such as the pandemic. So would you say that this kind of poetic, deeper truth was a kind to epistemologically and also psychologically and aesthetically cope with the situation?
Do we want to go into the whole topic of truth and documentary? I can only share my point of view, which I never believed that truth exists as such, and therefore I never thought that documentary was about truth, but more that documentary is a way to engage with reality, and therefore it's our own process to try to engage and normally formulate and visualize or to speak about what matters to us. And within that logic, definitely the Corona Haikus is a form of documenting. The difference with what we would normally see as a documentary in the linear and the audiovisual world is that a linear documentary is a finite piece of work. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It has been constructed and edited. While a space like the one, and I call it a space, thinking about the open space idea of documenting as a living, evolving documentary where people are documenting their way of living through the pandemic. And so it retains the idea of using media as a way to document your being. Is this truth? Well, it's, you know, especially since it is a co-creative endeavor, it is a whole series of individual truth and moments of truth that together, I think, actually are a pretty good portrait of the complexity of our lives. And in that case, of the complexity of a situation where life actually stopped and all the trauma that comes with that. So yes, for me, it is a complex truth. And therefore, even so much more interesting than what we could have achieved with a linear format. But I don't know, what do you think, Sandra?
One thing that my practice has showed me and my walk in life as a human being is that truth is a construct, as is an interpretation of our own reality. And what is true for me might not be true for you. So in that sense, my own truth can only really represent who I am and not necessarily who you are. But what I can do with the way I live my own truth is to go through that interpretation in a way that I can bring you along so you can see my point of view. It doesn't mean that it is your truth, but it allows you to see me and to see what I believe. And that's what happens when we go to different topics in documentary. And with Corona Haikus, what has happened is that, as Sandra said, it was a view and an interpretation of the reality, because what we were doing was framing in a way that the reality we needed to see and to go through was interpreted on those haikus.
As I was listening to you, you opened a new window in my head, which was that if you think about the format of the visual haikus being three photos, the truth, the telling, the meaning is actually normally not in the three photos, but in the linking the three photos. How does your brain, mind look at three photos and what does it construct as an association to make out of three pieces a message? And so I think it was particularly suited for what we were trying to do, but also particularly fitting with the idea of subjective truth that, you know, and constructive truth that we both have. Because whichever three photos I'm going to propose as a Corona Haiku, I will bridge them in my own construction with a path that makes it meaningful to me. But anybody who will read them on Facebook will first be attracted to these three photos and construct their own bridging. And so each haiku is reconstructed and represent a different meaning, truth, and understanding for every single person who is actually watching them. So I think it's maybe even more suited than what we had thought. This was not thinking that we had then. But now that I'm thinking about it, I think actually it is even more allowing for personal meaning and construction of truth because the format is so elusive and does not oblige anybody to follow a single way of interpreting it.
So if I may sum up, there are two sides then. There was this aspect of interpreting one's reality and stopping and feeling and connecting with the moment, with the situation, maybe also accepting it. And then there was also this idea that the visitors kind of discovered something new in the pictures. Maybe we could get back to this idea and try to peel the onion for whom the project was created and for what purpose people used then the haikus and maybe also the exchange with others.
We started thinking, okay, who's this project for? And we thought the first answer was for everyone. Of course, that was marked wrong as not project is for everyone. We knew that this project was going to be for people interested in connecting feelings with images and being able to connect it with words. So in that sense, it would apply to anyone that could have a phone, see an image around them and create a story for themselves and willing to share it on a social media platform. We went through a demographic and we thought, yes, creative people probably will find it easier to do it. We believe that photographers are filmmakers or artists. We were also hoping that anyone that could connect with what was happening inside them and see the reflection outside could do it. And in a way, somehow that's what happened. But it was really surprising and really beautiful to see other type of people that were much more interesting in understanding the meaning of what they were going through.
In this sense, could one even speak of an artistic intervention consisting in the act of documenting a transformative intervention, as it had an impact on how people were not only perceiving their surroundings, but also on how they were dealing with the situation of social distancing, of uncertainty?
Something that I like very much of the project is that we could see what the activity was doing to ourselves. What it meant for us was the possibility of stopping, looking around, seeing what was calling our attention, connecting with that, taking a photo and creating a visual haiku from that. That's the intention that we had. And then later on, we realized what people were doing, that there were many other things coming up of that activity, of that interaction, of that suggestion.
How would you then describe these other effects beside the act of attentive perception and creation?
What we realized was that it had a sort of layered structure of impact, I think. So the first one is very much on the individual who is posting, because before even posting, what you really are asked to do is to feel inspired to do your visual haikus. And making the visual haikus really means that you are looking around you and you're stopping. You need to stop in order to look. And the invitation is not just to look at what looks pretty, but to look inside. So you're looking at your environment, trying to understand what is the resonance inside you to grab the feeling that you are going through. And so there is this dynamic between what is my feeling and how do I see it in my environment, which actually is an act of self-care in the sense that it demands you to connect to you, to yourself, and to your exterior, which was something that at that specific moment was very difficult because most of us were just not used to stay at home. So this connection was about reconnecting. So I think that was the first level of impact, which, you know, as a person who is creating a visual haiku, you have to reconnect to yourself, to your emotion, and at the same time to your environment. And by doing it, by creating your haiku, what happens is that you, because the visual haiku also has a text, you are doing that effort of linking, of making sense of it and of formulating and speaking about it. So it's like you become aware and conscious of your feelings. So basically, I think that by the act of making the haiku is somehow we would speak about it now as an act of self-care, because it demands a level of mindfulness. And it's like a tool that allows you to be mindful. And so this is something you do for yourself. But the moment you decide to actually put it online, then you enter into another dimension, because sharing, putting it on Facebook, actually means that you want to be seen. So you pass from a stage of, I'm aware of what I'm feeling, to a kind of empowerment of your own voice, where you say, and I want to say it to the world or to the community. And so that's where you move, I think, in terms of impact, from a level of the individual to a level of the community. And the moment you post it online and you put it on Facebook, well, just being seen, I think, has already an impact on you, especially when what you allow is people to share moments of vulnerability. And there were a lot of moments of vulnerability and moments of rage and moments of fear and moments of loss and of grief. And those are things we normally don't share easily. And somehow this platform allowed for it. So there is a sort of catharsis through the group that also happens. And then there's the third layer, I think, of impact. And maybe this is what you were referring to when you were thinking about the onions and the layers of the onions, which is that once your voice is there and seen, then other people can comment. And so now you start engaging into a logic of network. So this impact that started very much in your own core and became like a gift of being seen now becomes something that others can react to, they can like it, they can expand it, and sometimes actually generate their own creativity. And so it's like if this opening of your moment of awareness was now given to the community. And I think that creates a sort of solidarity feeling. We have thought of it as a community care, although this is probably a word that came after I finished the project. But the way I see it now is that it's a project that has layers of impact that goes from the individual to the community in a very specific way. And I think that is quite fascinating.
And on that, I want to add that projects that happen in social media and that comments that happen in social media or activity that happens in social media, we tend to be pretty much scared of the reaction of the community, because social media has lent itself to be a place for scathing comments, for anger, for attacks. But something very particular and something very beautiful happened with the community of Corona Haikus. And it was that people somehow, by the fact that probably, and this is just a speculation, that we all felt very vulnerable sharing what we were creating, we were also willing to receive others. And in that sense, there was a lot of respect, support, acceptance. And that made of the community of Corona Haikus a community that was a safe space. In that also, Sandra and I had a lot to do, but we were taking care of the space and making sure that there was no spam, the things that normally happen in this kind of projects. But basically what happened is that, to our surprise, the community grew in a way that they were actually caring for each other. They were supporting each other. And also it generated connections amongst themselves that are also still going on right now. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that's why a platform like Facebook ends up being a good way of connection, and it's a reusing of a social media platform into something else.
I think also that there is something that really fascinates me about the type of respect and care that got generated in the Facebook community of the Corona Haikus. Now, to give some numbers, I mean, when we started, and that was April 2020, we just invited our friends. So I don't know how many friends we have on Facebook, but I suspect, you know, say, you know, maybe 50 friends each, basically. I don't know. I don't have the numbers, but that was the idea. Now, what happened is the project lasted during the 10 weeks of the lockdown. And then lockdown has been different in different countries. But since I live in the UK, pretty much matched and got a bit longer than the lockdown in the UK. And during those 10 weeks, we ended up having pretty much 1,000 people you know. So what I'm trying to say is that what I found fascinating is that most of those people, I have never met them. I mean, they are not people that I know, let's call it, in real life. And so I've been thinking about how can it be that people who really don't know each other, and the only thing that they're sharing is a situation, which is quite dramatic, and a format, which is the compulsory format of the three photos and a short text. How can it be that people who don't know each other at all manage to support each other with such a certain level of, I was about to say tenderness, or probably the right word is comes in French and is bienveillance, which I think in English is benevolence, but it just never sounds the same to me. Yeah. So how can this level of benevolence be possible in between a community of people who do not know each other fundamentally? And the image who comes to mind is the image of dancing tango. Now, tango is a very particular form of dancing because the position you have to adopt when you're dancing is to actually be off balance. So, you know, forget the steps, but the whole point is that, you know, when you dance, you depend on the other to have your stability. If the other moves out, you are supposed to fall and vice versa. And so in order to dance together, you need to get right that precise point of balance where you're not too heavy on the other, because if not, the whole joy of dancing is gone. You're not too light either, because if you're too light, your presence, your sense of presence is not there. The other person cannot feel you. And so you just need to have that perfect codependence with the other, where you need each other, and yet at the same time, you are independent.
This idea of dancing a tango together then is a very, very nice description of what other people call co-creation, but which is sometimes a bit, it has got the connotation of very economic, media economic contexts. Thus, I really, really like this idea of tango dancing together. And how would you describe your role in this tango, in this mass dance? Because as you said, you were the initiators, you moderated somehow, but you framed it, you provided a context. How would you describe your function there?
We were the initiators, as you said, Anna, of the project. And also we were participants. We were constant participants. We were posting almost every day. Sandra posted every day. I posted almost every day too. That was also a way of guiding the community, that people that have created it are also engaged with it. It was a way to, for ourselves, to live it as we were suggesting it. So we were inviting people to be part of something, but we were already inside it. We were putting ourselves at the level of participants. And in a way, we also had to sometimes step out of that to be able to see what was going on in the community. But the best way to sense something is to be inside. Sometimes, yes, you need to have a little bit of a distance to realize in general what is going on and to understand how you can do that. So it was very much going in and out, going in to being part of, to being involved, to sense it from within, but also being able to come out to see, okay, this is what's going on within the project. And what's going on within the project is that throughout the weeks that we were together, we needed to adapt. We needed to adapt to the dynamics that were happening inside. And I can perfectly talk about these dynamics as well as a tango metaphor or as a dancing metaphor on what happens in a choreography when the elements of the choreography are not or you feel that they are a little bit out of tune. So what do you do? It's not necessarily the idea of as a conductor, because if a conductor like dictates sometimes the movements and the tones, but in a way it can do like a choreography director, a conductor, and also very much as I as I said it once, as a guardian as well, as a protector of what the community is. So in that sense, that idea of being able to adapt, to listen, is very much about listening what's going on, to tuning in. Okay, the posting and the energy is going towards somewhere else. We need to do something. And it was what the community and the activity of the community was dictating, was generating in us our own reactions. We were reacting according to what's going on in the community. So in that sense, we were very much listening, paying attention, being involved, but at the same time being aware that there were changes. And that's when, for instance, we decided that we needed a new information on the weekends, that we wanted to include other people, that we wanted to start closing the project. It was all very much connected to what was going on in the community and very much in tune of how we were walking inside and outside it too.
So it was about, let me sum up, it was about listening. It was about movement, about dynamics then, which sounds very much like something very living and not so much like one might get the first impression. There are three pictures, they are fixed, there's no movement image, it's just three pictures, but there's so much movement in it, there's so much voice in it, voice and listening. And also your dancing metaphor brought up the idea of bodily, physically being there, because although it's a visual haiku, it sounds very bodily to me.
I think the embodiment is a phase that was already there. I actually quite like this metaphor of the dancing, because it seems to fit a lot of this idea of movement, and you can move while nearly in stillness, which is what was happening in the first lockdown. But I think it's important to say that we are speaking about the Corona Haiku project as the Facebook group, who then became also a website, which was pretty much done during the first lockdown. So we're speaking between April and May. Okay. And in the meantime, I think it is important to say that we are still pretty much in, well, for sure in isolation, and in the UK, other countries is different. We're in our third lockdown. And therefore, what I can see is that it is difficult to speak about the Corona Haiku project as something that had stopped in June, since the need of the community has moved and is still there. We're still living shock of having a life which is isolated, but the way we need to express this shock might be changing. And I think this is the thing that we are starting to see. And somehow I'm looking at those three lockdowns that we have gone through like three movements. I think today I'm into my musical and dancing metaphors, excuse me. If I had to put words into the movements of those lockdowns, I would say that the first one was like an unexpected stillness. You know, the world stopped, and so the movement was we needed to be somehow forced and encouraged to look at stillness and to accept introspection. And for that type of need, the visual haikus was perfect, because it allowed us to do exactly that. Okay, but then by June we got out of that. You know, most countries, I mean, it's a bit difficult to say, because obviously Corona Haikus is an international project. And so worldwide, we have different seasons, different lockdowns. So it's a bit difficult to generalize. But I would say that for sure, when we decided to stop the Facebook side, let's say, although the Facebook is still open, but let's say we started closing what we had called the Corona Haikus project, is also because people were not dancing anymore. You know, as when you do a party, there is always, you know, a group of two or three who really are the late core dancers and stay until super late. But if the party is half empty, you know, you understand that it's pretty much time to close it. Yeah. The summer has been a moment of mild freedom, not the same in other parts of the world. But what happened, I think, is that in the second lockdown, which for us in the UK was pretty much around October, what happened then is that it felt completely different. It felt different because this time we did not particularly want anymore to be into introspection. And what came out was more a sort of a situation of we were confronted with the bare essentials of our lives. By then, we were all working from home. Our friends were seeing each other less and less and less. So it's like if life had shrunk. And so no one wanted to share anything anymore. So although we did start and we did propose again in Corona Haikus around fall, you know, because some people did ask us, do you want to start again sharing? We have started it, but we could see that, you know, that was a party that was not gelling. To take photos and to document their feelings was not anymore what was needed. And so I think since then we started thinking about what is it that is needed. And this is where we get, I think, to the third lockdown, which is much more a call for embodiment.
Sandra, can I add something that I think it's important, which is the realization and also not only the observation, but the proof through a form that we send out to our participants and the clear idea that there was screen fatigue.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and this is when a platform doesn't work anymore. You know, if people are into screen fatigue because by, you know, 6 months later, you know, we are all spending our life in front of a computer, the last thing you want to do is to connect with your friends through Facebook. I think that is where our duty as guardians and good tango dancer is to actually realize that there are moments where you need to change the format. To me, or at least the reflection we are into now, is that because of the screen fatigue, because of the being locked, and because of this accumulation of frustration, what is needed somehow might be in this phase of the pandemic is to manage to find ways to use the body to process the emotions. So to somehow heal. And from all these excess of emotions through the body, and to allow this for a movement that comes from within and starting to take maybe an empowerment and responsibility and to start to move on and get out of the pandemic whenever that will be possible. And it's going to be a very gradual movement. So I think this is where we are right now, thinking about the idea of, for sure, the visual haikus idea. So visual poetry is not what is needed, most of our community. And we are starting to think, could it be that dancing poetry, so living poetry in our body, as opposed into through our forms and through our aesthetic, could that be actually what is really needed now?
At the beginning of our conversation, I invited you to travel back in time. And now, at the end of our inspiring talk, maybe we could travel into the future, not only into the future of Corona Haikus as a project, but what do you think will documentary in general look and feel like? Will it feel different after Corona? Will it look different?
Well, I don't think that world events ever eradicate sort of communication traditions, or, you know, the documentary will keep being a very open format. And I don't think that, you know, it's the end of documentary as we know it. That will continue. What the pandemic has done is that it has allowed pretty much everybody to experiment on their own with the media that, you know, we all have, which is at our disposal, our mobile phones, social media platforms, and even that difference between broadcast quality and amateur quality has gone through the roof because every single television is using Zoom to do their own interviews. Yeah, so there's been a leveling of this idea that technology was and professionalism is what makes the difference. And so this re-empowers everybody and anybody to document their own life, which has been anyway a tendency of the last 20 years through social media platforms, the web, and our mobile phones. So that is something that was already there, but now it has just become complete common practice. And it had also opened a lot of possibilities to people who, well, like us, are considering, for example, to dance poetry and call it a documentary. I mean, how crazy is that, yeah? And in the same way, there are people who used to say that they worked in theater and now are using Zoom or to create happenings which are not really theater, a little bit documentary and a little bit something else. So it's like there is a hybridization of everything that can be seen by some as, again, empowering people to document themselves. Now, if we want to go into the long discussion of can we call it documentary? Well, I think I personally already gave my answer. I'm much more interested in the act of documenting than in the fact of calling something a documentary. So in that sense, yes, there has been a big shift because I think everybody feels entitled to be creative and probably doesn't give a damn anymore about what it is called because no one knows what it is called. And what is important is actually just to use the medium that are available to have a voice. And so I think that might be an important shift.
I think that academics are going to have a blast finding out different names. We love finding names for everything and redefining concepts. But Anna, to answer your question, I think I don't have an answer. I think that soon, and it isn't that soon, so that we can see that things have shifted. We can see that things have moved in fundamental ways. We cannot put the finger yet and what those fundamentals are, and we cannot talk yet. And I think it's going to take us some years to be able to understand what is happening right now. But the ground where we stand has been moved in that very quiet way, right? Like by being forced to be so still and to be so closed and to be so quiet, everything has moved, everything has shifted. Everything that we believed in has been like really shaken. So I know there are practices that are going on right now. I know we have experimenting. What has been happening is that there is a lot of experimentation in creation. And we are experimenting, we are exploring, we are creating different ways of being connected. And how is it going to be called? That's your job, guys. So we will continue just playing around, and we will count on you to call it and to give us a name to what we do.
Well, things remain thrilling and exciting, and I'd be happy to discuss it in maybe a year or 2 years. And thanks for sharing all these insights, and thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And a pleasure.
Also unsere erste Folge in der Reihe Kammerflimmern und mediales Rauschen, das Dokumentarische im Digitalen. Und ich hoffe, wir hören uns auch bald wieder, wenn wir mit der nächsten Folge online gehen. Nur um einen kleinen Ausblick zu geben, in den folgenden Episoden werden wir uns unter anderem damit beschäftigen, was überhaupt digitale Praktiken des Dokumentarischen sind und wie weit da das Spektrum reicht. Von partizipativ-dokumentarisch-künstlerischen Projekten wie Corona-Haikus über die sicherlich viel besser bekannten Web-Documentaries bis hin zu Virtual-Reality-Documentaries. Und wir werden diskutieren, inwiefern sich gerade diese im Entstehen begriffenen Praktiken, wie spannend, in ihren Möglichkeiten von linearen dokumentarischen Formaten unterscheiden. Aber wir werden, ähnlich wie in dieser Folge, auch über die Herausforderungen sprechen, die Interactive Documentaries mit sich bringen. Sowohl für die MacherInnen als auch für die UserInnen. Wir werden über randständige, aber deshalb nicht weniger faszinierende Projekte sprechen. Und wir werden uns mit Hypes wie VR-Nonfiction kritisch auseinandersetzen. Und vor allem darf ich mich jetzt schon auf wirklich spannende GesprächspartnerInnen freuen. In der direkt nächsten Folge werde ich mit Maike und Thomas Weber Professor für Medienwissenschaft an der Universität Hamburg und meinem Projektpartner, zunächst einmal kurz das Forschungsprojekt, das Dokumentarische im Digitalen, vorstellen. Und wir werden dabei auch darüber sprechen, wie man sich generell dem theoretisch und methodisch annähern kann, was als emergierende mediale Praktiken beschrieben wird. Also Felder, Praktiken, Phänomene und so weiter, die gerade entstehen, die sich noch nicht ausdifferenziert haben, bei denen es unter Umständen auch noch gar keine eigene Theoriebildung gibt. Und natürlich wird es auch demnächst wieder eine reguläre Folge von Kammerflimmern und Mediales Rauschen geben. Und Shorts. Und was da alles als nächstes ansteht, das findet sich auf unseren Social-Media-Kanälen. Also folgen und bis dahin eine gute Zeit.